Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. So whether you're tuning in live or catching up later, stay ahead with four big stories that really count. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's health system nearing breaking point as pressure continues to mount. Operation Vulindlela pushes new reforms to break growth barriers, India and Pakistan teetering on the brink of war, and women quitting jobs that ignore flexibility. It's Thursday, the 8th of May. Now, with the National Health Insurance Act now signed into law but under intense legal scrutiny, there are growing fears, I think, that we're heading into reform without consensus, clarity, or even the cash to back it. At the same time, more people than ever are falling through the cracks of a system, straining under inequality, underinvestment, and political uncertainty. So the question is, how do we move forward? What is real inclusive reform going to look like? And how do you build partnership that doesn't just talk but delivers? And someone at the center of this debate and ahead of an important conference on the topic is Dr. Katlego Moturi, who's Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders. Dr. Moturi, a very warm welcome to you. And are you concerned that all this talk about reform is heading too quickly in the wrong direction?
We are very concerned, Jeremy. Firstly, we need to have done this yesterday. We are already on the back foot. All the markers to measure health outcomes are against us. We've seen recent reports from the World Health Organization that none, if at any of the countries that have signed up for universal health coverage, would achieve the 2030 target. So we should be moving fast, but in the right direction. And I think the challenge is we are not having the right sort of discussions. We are not considering the right sort of advice, because most of the things that you've spoken about have been considered in one way or another. But as we've seen now also with the NHI Act, a lot of input went into it, and most of it was not considered.
Do you think we're at something of a nexus point now where it's too late to affect any kind of progressive U-turn?
No, I think it is still possible. Maybe the legislative process is a bit hamstrung, firstly because the bill in its current form we think is not the right sort of tool, and the stage where it's at. But I think, as we've seen, we've got other tools. We've seen recently with the intervention around the VAT increase, the courts were able to intervene and we came to some sort of corrective measure. So it is not too late for us to have these dialogues. It is not too late to consider the input from all stakeholders. And unfortunately, we many times talk past each other. Maybe the so-called ideologies interfere in terms of us looking at the technical requirements of what needs to be done. But we can still have the necessary dialogue and correct it.
You talk about the importance then of those decisions. Are you still engaging with government in any respect? And are you sensing, in spite of the ideologies that you have referenced, there is still something of a willingness to listen?
There was an attempt at dialogue, I think it's about a few months ago, but those efforts have been abandoned because a number of the organizations submitted those inputs that the president had asked for. And as we are told, they are still sitting on the desk of the Ministry of Health. And that's why you've seen organizations that had initially not entertained the legal route have subsequently resorted to the court. So we are not having any dialogue, meaningful or otherwise, at the moment.
Have you or has your organization lost confidence in the health minister?
I think since the reappointment, haven't had a lot of engagement. And I think he came in already on the back foot. We understand that the government is grappling with the reconfigured structure. I don't think they have quite found their place. I still think that with the necessary dialogues, and I want to go back to the issue of the ideologies, sometimes we allow that to interfere with what needs to be done. And I can't remember, one of the former presidents was talking about rhetoric that and ideology, that the population will not feed or benefit from rhetoric. They actually want actual results. And I think we need to put a lot of these things that stop us from having meaningful discussions and just look at what needs to be done. I think the roadmap is there. There are countries and entities that have walked this path before. We've seen their errors and even their failures. We can learn from that. And we have enough expertise in this country and even our own experience, whether you're talking public or private, to be able to craft something workable from those.
But very difficult, I imagine, to change entrenched ideology, and that's always going to hamstring you.
Yeah, it is. And as we fully subscribe to what the WHO advises in terms of setting up the right pillars for healthcare, one of those is leadership and governance. That's where it should actually start. We need to make sure that we have the right leadership, the right governance structures, and those who advise the leadership should have the requisite expertise.
Let me ask you one final question. As you're well aware, and you referenced this earlier, the High Court has now ordered the President to release the decision-making records for signing the NHI into law. What are you expecting that this record is going to reveal?
We expecting the record would show that there was a lot of input that the President should have considered to not sign the bill. We are aware of the many submissions that our organizations made, and most of these inputs that we are aware of were against the President going forward. So we want to be able to demonstrate that the bill and actually the process that entertained its passage was irregular and should actually be sent back. And by seeing that there was irrationality in the decision-making process, that the leadership did not fulfill its mandate and actually veered from their constitutional responsibility.
Dr. Katlego Mothudi, thank you very much indeed. Strong words there, Managing Director of the Board of Healthcare Funders.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, you'll know that Operation Vulindlela was launched during the economic wreckage of the pandemic as government's flagship reform drive. And phase two now promises to go even further, tackling everything from grid bottlenecks and freight rail dysfunction to housing, water and municipal decay. But this is my question. Is this just another lofty roadmap, or is it going to do something meaningful to shift South Africa's growth trajectory? With me now is Rudy Dix, who's at the center of all of this. He's head of project management in the presidency. And let's talk about some of the claims and the realities behind them. So, Rudy, a very warm welcome. And let's start with this. How do you rate the actual impact of phase one on things like GDP growth, unemployment and private investment so far? I mean, is there any evidence of a significant improvement here?
Well, no evidence yet, Jeremy, because that's ultimately what we want to see. We want to see that what we do impacts on gross fixed capital formation and on employment, right? And so the reforms are still at a very beginning stage, and you've got to carry through. So lots of the investments, for example, around private generation, The logistics, for example, on opening up the rail network and the concessioning of the ports. These are important things that would have impact as soon as they carry through. They're not reflected as much as it would be in the growth figures, but certainly in the gross fixed capital formation, you'll see a little bit of an uptick in the last year and a half in fixed investments, and that's quite important. So we've got to work pretty hard. It's about creating confidence. It's about getting investors to understand that the reform is about opening up the economy and that we're creating opportunities for private investment.
Let's look at phase two now. Dozens of reforms have been listed, electricity, water, logistics, digital IDs, etc., etc. But in your opinion, then, what are the top three measurable priorities here?
Just to correct you, they're not dozens. I mean, there are seven, right? We'll continue with electricity reforms, and that's going to be important. I mean, from a network perspective, electricity and logistics are fundamental. Those are the ones that drive economic growth. Those are the ones that create confidence and investment. So we'll continue to focus and carry through those reforms. The three new reforms are also going to be critical for us because they talk about the inclusivity of the kind of structural changes that we want to see. So this relates to local government, and it's about the coalface of delivery. It's about basic services, it's about better functioning utilities, professionalization, making sure that services are delivered towards citizens and to businesses. Spatial inequality, again, also very transformative. How do we create densifications of cities, get people close to where they work or where they or places of where they shop, using public transport, having different models of developing housing and housing developments, using land. Thirdly, also digital and digital transformations. Those are critical. No-brainer. Digital identification and digital payments, right? These are such an important part of efficiencies and ensuring that we bring people into a digital system that allows us to be able to target much, much, much better. So these are going to be an important part of continuing old reforms and specifically focusing on the network sectors, but also look at a more inclusive set of reforms, those three new ones that we've announced at phase two as well.
Rudy, service delivery is a well-worn trope in South Africa. How do you light a rocket under local government in order to progress that, given that there has been a large history of failure?
Absolutely. I've said it on countless occasions, Jeremy. We acknowledge that it's no easy task. Right? There are a whole series of complexities. Firstly, legislative and constitutional complexities, where there are quite distinct laws that are provided for functioning of municipalities. It's not simply coming into the space, parachuting and telling municipalities what we do. We don't have that authority. We've got to work in an intergovernmental relations framework, collaborative approach. But already we've seen some signs of that collaboration in eThekwini, for example, and more recently in the city of Johannesburg. It's about getting the municipalities and working with them in a manner that understands that service delivery and accountability is going to be important. So we want to develop a collaborative approach. It's not about the stick. It's not about using legislation to enforce service delivery. It's about going back to the basics and ensuring that we design utilities, for example, you know, and the functions of investments in utility responsibilities, distribution for both water and electricity, servicing, fixing roads. These are going to be important things. And we've got to develop strong accountability mechanisms. So it's no easy task. It's going to be a challenging and important task, but at least I think for both eThekwini and City of Johannesburg, as I explained, there are some really good green shoots showing around how we can collaborate between three spheres of government.
But surely at some point you've got to bring out that stick, given that there is a history of corruption and inefficiency in many of those nodes.
Perhaps incentives is a good way of trying to do it, right? Because those are important. Part of the reform, for example, on professionalizing and creating efficient utility services that could have ring-fence funding and to ensure that they put money back into maintaining and expanding infrastructure is what is currently happening with the trading services reform. So you could do it through incentives, but you know, part of the process of local government is also, as you see, one of the reforms is the policy reform on the white paper for local government. Now, we've never done any changes since the dawn of democracy around local government. So those are certainly areas of consideration to take into consideration when we do look at the policy paper on local government, and which is the white paper process around how do we enhance and ensure greater levels of accountability and hold people, feet to fire? You know, that's going to be important.
So when it comes to local government then, which we've discussed what the issues are, surely there would be some concern about extending the Public Service Commission's mandate and any difference it's going to make on corruption, as I've mentioned, and even cadre deployment.
It would, because the professionalisation framework is quite critical. Remember, the Public Service Commission is already an important institution that, for example, myself, as a bureaucrat at a national level, I'm covered by the Public Service Commission. And certainly the current legislative amendments on there is looking at doing that. But it's not just about corruption, but it's also about the professionalisation. Importantly, given the changing dynamics in the political environment, you know, in coalition politics, that we've got to have a clear separation between the bureaucracy and the elected leaders. We got to continue doing service delivery and ensuring that government functions. Political leaders come and go during elections. That's the most important part. And I think we got to do that at a local government level as well. And that's an important thing. You know, we're professional. We don't play party politics. It's about ensuring that we ensure that the wheels of government continue to turn.
Rudy Dix, thank you very much indeed. Head of Project Management in the Presidency. I do appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
All right, let's shift the focus internationally now. And tensions between India and Pakistan have escalated dramatically after India launched Operation Sindoor, precision airstrikes targeting alleged terror infrastructure in Pakistan and Pakistan-administered Kashmir. The operation, in retaliation for a deadly attack in Indian-administered Kashmir that killed 26 tourists. Pakistan has condemned the strikes as an act of war, reporting civilian casualties, and is vowing retaliation. Now, with both nuclear-armed nations exchanging threats and artillery fire, the risk of a broader conflict looms large. So let's take a look at some of the implications. I'm in conversation with Sanusha Naidu, foreign policy specialist at the Institute for Global Dialogue. Sanusha, welcome to you. And given the history of Indo-Pakistan conflicts, how unprecedented is India's Operation Sindoor in terms, I guess, of scale and intent?
Yeah, I mean, good afternoon to you, Jeremy, and the listeners. I think it is it's something that's quite alarming in a sense, because we've got to look at the context. The last time that I can remember, and I stand corrected on this, is where India and Pakistan went into a full-scale kind of conflict and attack. You know, was the question around the independence of what we now know today as Bangladesh, which used to be East Pakistan. And then, of course, they India and Pakistan went into a kind of war in the period around the 60s, 70s, around there. So this time around, this whole thing around the issue of what had happened in terms of the attacks, the terrorist attacks that happened in that little resort in Indian-administered Kashmir, and the retaliation with Operation Sindoor is actually something that I think we have to be very, very cognizant of the context and what does this mean? Because obviously the sensitivity, but also the kind of volatility that exists in Kashmir between Indian administered Kashmir and Pakistan administered Kashmir, and you got this line of control, which has always been this kind of push and pull. They've kind of got to a point where they get to this crescendo. Basically, there's the fire over the line of control, etc., and then there's a kind of dissipation. But this time around, I think it's something that has to also link back to how the mood is being fueled in New Delhi, and in particular within the Modi government, and of course the kind of resonance this is finding in terms of nationalism as well, because the tensions are also high internally in India as well. And you've seen the way the Indian government has said that this was a precision attack, that there will not be any escalation, and they reported on the civilians that were basically caught in the attack, people that lost their lives. And of course this now means the question is, what is Pakistan going to do? Are they going to retaliate? How are they going to retaliate? So I think we've got to basically look at this now in historical context and say it's not necessarily that they're going to basically just kind of fire a few shots and then retreat. I think this is something much more, and given the nature and scale of how the Indian government has responded and the nature and scale of what the fact is that the Indian government has always accused the Pakistani authorities of turning a blind eye to insurgency groups that have manifested and mushroomed under and even they feel they've accused the military, the ISI, the military in the US, in Pakistan, of fermenting these groups.
Now, without sensationalizing the issue, you talk about a pronounced volatility. I did mention that both nations possess nuclear capability. Is there a threat of any kind of nuclear confrontation in the scenario, or would you dampen that down?
That has always been part of that debate, Jeremy. Whenever these two countries came to this kind of loggerhead around conflict, there was always that question of whether the nuclear capabilities and whether the activation and use of the nuclear would actually become part of the tension, part of the conflict, part of the instability. And this is part of the question that was raised about India's nuclear program. You know, was it for military purposes or was it for nuclear civilian energy? And so this whole thing around US in the around the George Bush Jr. years in the presidency, and how they managed to get the civilian program on the nuclear capabilities, kind of part of the nuclear supplier group and so forth. It's difficult to say, but you don't want to sensationalize it, as you rightly point out, because I think that the use of a nuclear approach or the implementation of a nuclear armament in the subcontinent of South Asia is very volatile. And of course, the question there is, how do you justify it? So I'm not sure if that is why there's so much of concern from the international community because of this issue. But what it does mean is that it's going to have, this conflict does have other implications. Right now, I think it's a question of, we've seen India talk to counterparts in terms of the external environment and the international context, but we it'll be interesting to see whether they speak to their BRICS partners as well, particularly because you've got Russia, China, and others there that also Russia has an interesting relationship with India, but China has an interesting relationship with Pakistan. And then, of course, there's the question of the US. So, indeed, the question of the nuclear, I think, let's not sensationalize it, because I think it would really be a big credibility test for both sides and a legitimacy crisis for both sides if they do use it. But the question is, what is the other military armaments and software they could use? Because India has been increasing its arms with short-range missiles. Pakistan has been saying with long-range missiles, you've got arms support and buying of arms from China in terms of who they're selling to, and then the Russians, etc. And of course, this is now the role of the of what external actors, military commercial interests with these two countries. That can also be something we need to look at.
And Sunisha, very quickly, the concern here is possibly a lack of mechanism for conflict resolution between the two countries. And if anything exists, whether they're actually being utilized effectively, I would suggest that that is probably not going to happen.
I agree with you. I think the challenge here is that the context of this conflict goes back to independence. It goes back to how Pakistan was created, where there was Muslim majority provinces that became part of Pakistan. So Pakistan is an acronym for all those areas. And India has always maintained, and I'm not sure if they've changed their stance, but they've always maintained that this was their issue to resolve. Even when Mandela brought it up in the corridors of the UN, it was always not to be part of the UN kind of conflict resolution, looking for the kind of negotiating of mechanisms around this. So I think this is going to be something that is going to be difficult, because India may not want that international interference, whereas Pakistan may want it. So there's that tension and that kind of volatility and elasticity, which I think doesn't give that who's going to come in and be a broker of this whole thing.
I do appreciate that very sharp analysis. That is Sunisha Naidu, Foreign Policy Specialist at the Institute for Global Dialogue.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this has been called South Africa's largest survey of working women, and the message is clear. Flexibility, financial security, and career progression aren't perks anymore. They've become deal breakers. According to the 2025 Working Women's Report from Recruit My Mum, nearly half of women are job hunting, not because they want to leave, but because too many workplaces still don't listen. But my question is, how actionable is all of this data, and what does it mean for employers navigating post-pandemic policy shifts? Well, joining us now is Philippa Geard, founder and CEO of Recruit My Mum. Philippa, a very warm welcome, and this is interesting. Let's start with flexibility. The survey says it's non-negotiable, but it's difficult, surely, to respond to employers who say productivity and, I guess, even company culture suffers without people in the office.
Yeah, thank you, Jeremy. You know, I think that flexibility is such an interesting word because I think it's often misunderstood. So flexibility can refer to location, it can refer to hours. There's a myriad of ways of unpacking what flexibility means. And what we've uncovered through this survey, which is an extensive survey in the South African context, is that women aren't looking for reduced working hours. They're not even looking to reduce how they work because financial stability for them is absolutely key. But what they're saying is that they would ideally prefer a hybrid way of working. So that's come out as the preferred way of working full-time with flexibility, which includes hybrid working. And I think that makes it very actionable for businesses. So it's not come back into the office 8 till 5, 5 days a week. It's we're looking for a level of flexibility which might include a hybrid way of working.
Philippa, aside from hybrid working, what else, in your opinion, then defines that word flexibility? It can be very wide-ranging.
Absolutely. And I think in understanding that is where employers really can help their employees, but also help their organizations. So if we unpack the location flexibility word, so that can be in office, it can be hybrid, or it can be fully remote. And within that, you've got a myriad of ways of just breaking that up and mixing it up. And so location is one aspect of flexibility. And then the second one is how people want to work in terms of numbers of hours. So we're seeing full-time definitely predominantly sought by women. Flexibility could be you can do a portion of your work at home. It could be that they work 4 days a week and they have one day off. That's the whole four-day work week concept that's taking you know, shape in around the world. There's also part-time work. So there is a group of women within the survey that said, yes, they would like part-time work. So it really is that combination of location and hours, and how do you get the best combination for both organization and employee?
Philippa, let's move from flexibility to loyalty, if we can. Your report says that women are loyal, yet nearly half are actively looking to leave. That seems like a contradiction to me.
It does feel like a contradiction, absolutely. But what we found is that on average, women will stay between 3 and 10 years at one organization, whereas the average employee in South Africa will stay for 2 years and 10 months. So women generally are very loyal, provided they're given the opportunity to work in the way that they want. So what the stats have shown us is when we ask them, what is your state of work currently? Almost 50% of them said, we're working, but we're looking for a job. And then, Jeremy, if we can just take it a step further, when we asked those who had been asked to come back to work to the office in more this year, so the question was, has your employer asked you to come back in the last 12 months in office? Of those people who said yes, that 50% jumps to 84% now looking for a job.
Philippa, let's move to career progression. For anybody, I guess it's a top priority, but there is a counter argument, I think. Many small businesses would say that there is simply isn't room to move up. What realistic advice would you give to employers with flat structures who are trying to deal with the challenge of career progression?
It's a great question because as we've seen that, you know, career progression and the lack of internal opportunities is a big barrier to career growth for women. And so our advice to companies that are flat, and there are many of them that have got flat structures and or they're in an economic situation where they aren't growing, and so they're not able to grow their teams, is to look at ways of growing skill sets. So giving people opportunity to run a specific project, a leadership opportunity, encouraging them to reskill or upskill. So within an organization, particularly with the onset of AI, is have a look at how one can take somebody and say, okay, well, I want to teach you a new skill. And that in itself is a level of growth.
You're also, again, if I've read the report correctly, around 20, let's call it a quarter of women surveyed say they've never been promoted. Do you think this is a failure of women not pushing hard enough, or, as I've heard on so many occasions before, employers simply not seeing or recognizing them?
I think it's a combination of both. I think that women absolutely do need to lean in, as Sheryl Sandler said, so well known for saying. I think that women do need to push for promotions. But I think there is also a level of being overlooked, and particularly in that middle management space where women possibly are looking for a bit more flexibility given that they're in those child rearing years. But the data again shows that women are incredibly ambitious. And if employers can see them for the skills that they bring, and we need to put this in the context of the fact that we really have a more highly educated female workforce constantly entering the workforce. So if you can retain them through those child rearing years and get them to senior management, you will then have a lot more diverse company, diverse leadership structures within companies. So I think it is a combination.
And let me ask you a final question. Pulling all of your findings together, you say it makes a powerful business case, point taken. But is there an actual return, or is there actual return on investment data for employers who've implemented some of the recommendations that you have made? In other words, to prove empirically that all of this actually works.
Yes, so the data around loyalty is very clear. It can cost you up to 200% of somebody's annual salary if they leave to replace them. And if you're looking at a skilled woman workforce that's relatively loyal, well, more so than the average, so they are loyal, if you can retain them, there is a saving on the bottom line to retaining them. So definitely around loyalty, there's a return on investment. The studies are mixed around productivity. So you definitely see studies where productivity goes up when people are allowed to work more flexibly and or remotely. And so from my side, my recommendation for employers is if you can put in structures to properly measure productivity, whether somebody is in the office or whether they're working remotely, it shouldn't matter. But ultimately, if that employee is happier and therefore more loyal and less likely to leave you, there's a definite bottom drop to the bottom line and saving for a company. And that makes enormous sense to do that.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to me today. That's Philippa Geard, founder and chief executive officer of Recruit My Mom. Thank you so much. And that is MoneyWeb at midday for today. We are live at noon weekdays. We're then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.